Okay, now let's go on to the next talk by Chris Thompson on soft gamma ray physics and possible relation to classical gamma ray bursts.
Okay, the beginning part of my talk will be made a bit easier by Jay's nice presentation at the end of his. Our knowledge of the soft gamma repeaters really begins with the activity associated with the March 5th event. And we had to wait 20 years for another burst that could be put in the same class. But that has, I think, strongly indicated that if not an entirely homogeneous class of sources, the soft gamma repeaters aren't what could be called a motley bunch. They can, most of them, be expected to produce that sort of spectacular burst at some time in the future. So the March 5th event, of course, was initiated by a very intense and narrow pulse, followed by a extended, much softer tail that was still hyper-Eddington at the inferred distance of the LMC, but with a clear 8-second periodicity, which was ascribed by most people to the periodicity of the neutron star. And recent detection of periodicity in other soft gamma repeater sources at about 5 7/2 seconds have, in the quiescent emission, I think, put that inference on a very solid ground. Now, the major development last August was, of course, a burst from SGR 1900 plus 14 with a very similar time profile, of course, a different spin period of about a little more than 5 seconds, and a somewhat lower energy and luminosity. Total energy probably about an order of magnitude or so below that of the March 5th event. These sources have been inferred to be young neutron stars based on their association with supernova remnants, N49 in the LMC for the March 5th burster. This is the beautiful radio maps by Frail and Kulkarni of the Plerion around 1806 minus 20. And 1900 plus 14 sits just outside a supernova remnant, and the most likely possibility is that this neutron star has been propelled out of the remnant at fairly high proper motion. The quiescent X-ray source associated with the March 5th burster is significantly displaced from the center of N49, and that implies a proper motion on the order of 800 kilometers a second or higher. Now, these sources have been inferred to be very strongly magnetized neutron stars, based especially on a number of properties of the March 5th burst. It's extreme energetics, it's extended soft emissions, which require a very strong magnetic field to contain the emitting plasma near the surface of the neutron star, the hyper-Eddington luminosity, especially of the initial pulse. If you want to get energy out of the interior of the neutron star at a rate of 10 million Eddington, you require a magnetic field stronger than 10 to the 14th Gauss just to couple internal, say, seismic modes to external Alphane modes. Now, this model predicted that these sources should be not only have fairly uniformly long spin periods, but also be expected to spin down quite rapidly. And in the case of an ordinary pulsar, we can deduce the surface dipole field, of course, from the vacuum dipole formalism. In the case of a magnetar, there is something fundamentally different, and that is that its rotational energy is significantly less than its magnetic energy. And its magnetic dipole luminosity, if it were to spin down purely by that mechanism is far below its quiescent X-ray, and in particular its non-thermal X-ray luminosity. So one can infer fairly directly that if these are isolated neutron stars, that they are quiescent particle sources, and with large luminosities in excess of the magnetic dipole luminosity. That has a significant effect on the spin down, as I noted in a paper with Blaze about a year ago, that particle flux will comb out the magnetic field lines, increase the magnetic field strength of a light cylinder, and thus increase the spin down torque. So that the spin down luminosity is basically the geometric mean of the bold magnetic dipole luminosity and the particle luminosity. What this means is that variations in the quiescent particle flux, which can certainly be expected given how intermittent these sources are as burst sources, will lead to variations in spin down rate. And indeed, Soft Gamma Repeater 1900 plus 14, excuse me, this should be 1806 minus 20. Soft Gamma Repeater 1900 plus 14 has been observed to spin down and at an accelerated rate around the time that it emitted the August 27th burst. So that may be consistent with this idea of particle-aided spin down. Now, I'd like to say a few words about fireballs associated with the initial spike of these superbursts, and in particular, talk a little bit about the radio mission that was associated with the August 27th event. The triggering of these bursts most plausibly takes place when magnetic stresses build up sufficiently, when the field in the interior of the star moves sufficiently out of magnetostatic equilibrium to stress the crust above its yield stress. And as a result, when the crust fractures, the magnetic energy released is significantly larger than the elastic energy that the magnetic field had put into the crustal lattice. Okay, so one is not limited by considerations of crustal elastic energy, which made that possible but not very plausible energy source for the March 5th event. Now, when a fracture takes place, the foot points of the magnetic field will move horizontally. That will send a pulse of Alphane radiation into the magnetosphere, which can bounce back and forth. And the transmission coefficient is quite large, and so the energy can rapidly be redistributed, in fact. And Blaze and I have looked at the nonlinear couplings between modes, which in a burst of the energy of the March 5th event will very quickly lead to a turbulent cascade via what we believe predominantly are three-mode couplings. And the key point here is that the wave motions at the outer scale have such a large amplitude that the particle density needed to support the associated electrical currents, the waves will have some perpendicular component of the wave vector and hence require an electrical current to support them. Those charged particle densities imply Thomson depths not too different from unity. And a cascade will produce higher wave number modes that rapidly force the charged particle density to a very large value. And along closed magnetic field lines, produce very effective thermalization, a trapped fireball, with most of the opacity provided by electron-positron pairs, except in a cold outer shell where material blown off the surface of the star can be the dominant source of opacity, ordinary ion electron matter. However, when the burst energy gets above a certain fraction of the dipole energy, and it need not be a very large fraction of the dipole energy, I mean a few percent, the some component of the Alphane wave flux will blow open the magnetic field lines fairly close to the star and force a paradominated outflow. And we deduced that the matter loading in that outflow has to be quite small, less than 10 to the minus 2 delta MC squared over E, if you want to avoid the hard peak associated with the initial pulse of the March 5th event be smothered by the baryonic opacity in the usual calculation. In the case of the August 27th event, there's a beautiful data by the Beppo-Sachs group, which shows quite a hard non-thermal spectrum. It doesn't extend far enough energy to be sure exactly what's going on. That is consistent just with passive cooling of charged, very energetic charged particles.
So beta minus 2 would be equal power per decade?
Yes. So photon index. Hmm? That's photon index.
Photon index. So this implies most energy at highest energy photons.
But there's it doesn't extend high enough to see the cutoff, at least in the published paper.
So much more energy.
Yes. I haven't yet seen a detailed analysis of the energy in that initial spike for the August 27th. First one may exist. But now, there's some very nice work by the group quite familiar to everyone from their work on afterglow and classical bursts with a detection of transient radio emission surrounding the SGR 1900 plus 14 with a delayed peak of around 10 days and then a very rapid drop off following that. Extremely rapid, T to the minus 2.6. Now, this is, of course, almost certainly associated with a blast wave driven by the particle emission during the August 27th burst. And the implied velocity of the set-off blast wave is below the speed of light unless the ambient medium is highly rarefied. And the delayed peak was associated by Vail et al. With a cavity that might pre-exist around the soft guarantee, driven, for example, by some pre-existing, some preceding output, burst output or quiescent or particle output. Now, I'd like to just focus on this a little bit because this is an interesting laboratory for examining this issue of field amplification shocks. You have here a burst energy divided by the energy in the ambient magnetic field within the shock radius of more than 10 million. And during the burst, because the source is so slowly rotating, one expects the magnetic field lines to be combed out, but not to carry much in the way of pointing luminosity. Using the calculation that Blaise and I did, you estimate that only 10 to the minus 5 of the energy carried out in unbound material comes off in the magnetic field. So it's likely, in fact, that a pre-ejected magnetic field or the magnetic field of the interstellar medium is the dominant trigger for synchrotron radiation. So this is exciting because we're in a situation fairly similar to what is believed to occur in classical gamma ray bursts. Unlike in an ordinary supernova explosion, you don't have a pre-existing pre-supernova, dense pre-supernova wind, which can be a significant source of magnetic flux. Now, one interesting implication is that because the radio light curve is very, very steep, it's difficult to see how you could develop into a set-off blast with b squared over 8 pi, some constant fraction of the post-shock pressure. That would result in a much more gradual decline in the radio light curve. So let's try something different. It's clear that magnetic fields can be tangled by Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities behind shocks. Let's just try some nonlinear relation between the swept up field, the field behind the shock and the synchrotron radiating regime through some power law relation where the power law index is greater than 1. So in order to take advantage of this nonlinearity, you require two successive shocks. Okay. One possibility is that you have a pre-burst outflow followed by the August 27th ejecta. Another possibility is that you have a pair fireball emitted during the initial second or so of the August 27th event, followed by a slower but still energetic and fairly fast baryonic outflow, say ejected during the extended soft emission for the following 300 seconds. So there's a simple calculation one can do, and that is just take two non-elasticity blasts, send one out, send the other one out, and look at the synchrotron flux that comes out. With this assumption of magnetic field amplification, you get a fairly flat light curve for the first shock. But then, if the first shock is able to develop a thin set-off shell, when the second shock comes along, it will compress it, and through this nonlinear relation between magnetic field and density, lead to a significant enhancement in the magnetic field in that doubly shocked layer, compared with the magnetic field that will be swept up later as the shock continues to propagate outward. And one can compare the time scaling after this second shock with the radial light curve. And it is close to a minus 2.5 power law for some time after the second shock passes. This is time since the first blast. And here are different power law relations between magnetic flux behind the shock and density. So these ripples are simply shocks reflecting back and forth in the compressed shell. So when one applies this to the data, one can estimate the energy of the particles in the second shock. Now, the spike here is quite narrow and tall if the shocks are perfectly spherical. If they're bigger in one direction than another, the spike will be smoothed out. So the agreement isn't bad. You do require that there be a delayed impact associated with some light travel delay from the source to the first shock. And the energy can be related, taking into account the efficiency with which energy is put into the electrons that are doing the synchrotron radiating, to the power law index between magnetic field and density in the following way. You seem to require a fairly large index, and in order to get for reasonable efficiencies, an energy comparable to the energy of the August 27th burst. In any case, to summarize, what this suggests is that when you have a very energetic explosion, there can be significant nonlinear amplification of the magnetic field, but not necessarily all the way to equipartition. Okay. Well, let's continue in a slightly more disjoint vein, at least disjoint as regards the classical gamma ray burst problem. These soft gamma repeater bursts involve tremendous release of energy in the exterior of the neutron star. In the trapped fireball model, a non-negligible fraction of that energy can be conducted into the crust while the fireball persists, about 1%. And that energy will be re-radiated after the fireball dissipates. So you can get something like this. You have the burst, you have a fairly flat X-ray output following the burst, and then with continued fairly steep power law emission, just representing the propagation of this delta function pulse deeper into the crust. Now, here's one burst detected by RXTE, which indeed shows extended emission following the main pulse. So there may be something to this. The importance of this as a diagnostic is twofold. First of all, you're testing for the presence of a trapped fireball rather than continuous emission with output from the interior of the star occurring at the same rate as the burst output. There were, I think, fairly strong a priori reasons given in our paper, 95 paper, why that sort of balanced emission shouldn't work, and why there should be a runaway to a trap fireball, but it would be very nice to have a direct experimental test of this. In addition, the amount of energy conducted into the crust is increased dramatically by a reduction in magnetic capacity, a fact that was first emphasized in the Estrella context by Bonapaczynski. And so one does require a fairly strong B in order to conduct about 1% of the energy into the crust, B bigger than 10 BQED. But there's another effect that needs to be considered. And that is that in the case of these superbursts, the internal temperature in the fireball, just assuming confinement volume of order, the volume of the neutron star, is approaching an MeV, a little bit less than that for the August 27th burst, and perhaps as small as a tenth of an MeV for the much shorter repeat bursts. That's high enough to photodissociate heavy elements sitting near the surface of the star, down to actually quite a considerable depth, down to a depth at which the electrons, for example, are beginning to become relativistic. And a considerable mass of material can be suspended in the magnetosphere at these very high temperatures while the fireball dissipates, after which it will settle down to the surface of the star. But at that point, the surface is cold enough that it won't burn. So you can have hydrogen and helium accumulating in a layer on the surface of the star following the one of these big bursts. And then if a second burst comes along, heat conducted into the same area of crust can reignite this fuel and lead to quite extended hydrogen burning emission following the repeat burst. The interesting thing about this expression is that B cancels out of it. The main effect of B is to determine the minimum time at which you get this asymptotic time scaling of T to the minus 3/4. Okay, it might be worthwhile to make a few comments about where magnetars come from, given that there was this possible association between the August 25th burst last year and the supernova, peculiar type 1C supernova. Now, if one wants to get rapid field decay in the interiors of these magnetars, one requires interior fields above 4 times 10 to the 15th Gauss. And the way that comes about is as follows. The transport of the field through the interior is basically by antipolar diffusion. The magnetic field drags the charged particles with it through background sea of neutrons. But the rate at which the field can diffuse is basically limited by the rate of beta reactions that allow the electron fraction to relax back to beta equilibrium. This has been calculated by Pethick, by Goldreich and Leisnegger especially, in a more general context. In the specific context of magnetars, the decay of the field, the frictional heating of the core, will feed back positively on the transport rate by raising the temperature, because the beta reactions are such a strong function of temperature. And that can't blow up to infinite temperature simply because neutrino cooling will take over. And there is a well-defined equilibrium at which the neutrino cooling balances the frictional heating by the field. That corresponds to a surface temperature, well, surface luminosity of about 10 to the 35 ergs per second, just in the range of the soft gamma repeater and AXP, anomalous X-ray pulsar, sources. Now, a field this strong is not easily consistent with amplification in the stages of evolution of the star before the final collapse to a neutron star. However, within the neutron core and also in the neutrino heated gain region outside the neutrino sphere and below the shock, there is vigorous convection. Now, we made a very simple, purely phenomenological argument indicating strong fields in these convective regions. That was not based on a theoretical calculation of dynamo amplification, which does not exist, at least on any firm grounds. Rather, it was based simply on the observation that the internetwork magnetic field of the Sun is very strong and corresponds to in volume average pressure about 10% of turbulent pressure. And it's almost uniformly distributed over the solar disk at solar minimum, suggesting that there might be some independent small-scale amplification mechanism within the Sun that is decoupled from the global dynamo that produces the dipole field and the oscillating sunspot patterns. Now, if you make that simple scaling to these convective regions of the neutron star or its atmosphere, you end up with fields of a few times 10 to the 15th Gauss. In the case of the atmosphere, after allowing for compression during gravitational infall. And the key point is that the square of the convective velocity divided by the square of the freefall velocity is 100 times larger during these last stages of convection than it was during, say, silicon burning. Since the magnetic energy scales directly with the gravitational energy during expansion or contraction, that indicates that it's the last stage of convection driven by neutrinos that is by far the most effective site for magnetic field amplification. And if in addition the spin period is less than a few milliseconds, then you have all the conditions required for a global helical dynamo in the sense that the convective overturn time is less than is longer than or comparable to the spin period. Now, this is surprising at first sight, and I think it's this part of the model that has caused people to swallow the most, in the sense that the inferred birth rate of soft gamma repeaters and anomalous X-ray pulsars is about 2%, maybe 10% of the type 2 supernova rate in our galaxy. What this suggests is that a large, not negligible fraction of supernova cores are quite rapidly rotating. That is hard to achieve. I've tried a long time, and maybe there are other people who can figure out how to do it, with any sort of binary mechanism. It suggests instead that there's some intrinsic anisotropy in the supernova mechanism that may not have been perfectly captured yet by models, especially models involving neutrino heating. Well, I think the most plausible way of producing that rapid rotation is to have a little bit of material at the end fall in asymmetrically, 1/10 of a solar mass, maybe 2/10 of a solar mass at most. I think that possibility was noted in the context of pulsars long ago, 10 years ago, by Chevalier. Well, there is one interesting implication of that model, and that is that even a tiny amount of material that requires enough angular momentum to form a Keplerian disk will produce a very dramatic interaction with the neutron star. Early on, the material is essentially flowing without being able to cool, except perhaps by neutrino cooling near its surface during the first stages of the inflow. And this inflow is advection dominated. You can easily work out that the accretion rate drops off as T⁴/⅓. Eventually, the disk becomes radiative. And if the neutron star has been spun down near its equilibrium spin period in this hyper-Eddington accretion phase, you can compare the rotational energy in the neutron star with the gravitational binding energy of this torus at the point where the disk becomes radiative and presumably accretion becomes much slower. And it's a lot larger, whether B is 4 times 10 to the 14 Gausses we have normalized here, or whether B is in the pulsar range. But the interesting thing is that if the field is in the pulsar range, then you're almost guaranteed to blow away this disk, because there's enough momentum carried by the spin down flux of the central neutron star to apply momentum m disk times the circular velocity at the outer orbit of the disk to the disk material. In the magnetar case, this momentum balance argument breaks down, and it's not entirely clear whether you will entirely be able to blow away the disk. Let me just show one picture, one possible and very speculative supernova mechanism that could achieve this sort of anisotropy is one in which the bounce shock fails. That is, neutrino heating is not sufficient to blow it out. And what I've considered in an upcoming paper is that accretion will shear sufficiently a magnetic field below this failed shock to produce a low density component of the post-shock flow that dominates the volume. And if that happens, if there is an effective instability, and there are, I think, very indicative arguments that such an instability exists, you will get a global Rayleigh-Taylor distortion of the accretion shock, which grows in volume as material of this low density is injected progressively beyond this radius of, say, 100 kilometers where the accretion shock stalls. The nice thing about this is that eventually this shock is not able to expand quasi-statically, which is what is required for this asymmetric structure. And it converts into a running shock. And you can then estimate the amount of momentum imparted to the central neutron star, and it's about corresponds to a proper motion of a few hundred kilometers per second. So, 10 more minutes. Okay. Well, that was a little wild. Let me get back to something. A little bit more closely tied to the SGR data. One of the arguments that has been given, and actually in favor of accretion as an energy source for the persistent emission of the SGR sources, is that their spectra contain a non-thermal component. In the case of the anomalous X-ray pulsars, which appear to be closely related to the soft gamma repeater sources in quiescence, but don't appear to burst, this high energy index is about 3 to 4 photon index. Whereas in 1806 minus 20 and 1900 plus 14, it's more like in the photon index of 2. Now, Duncan and I looked at two basic modes of energy release in the interior of a magnetar. One involved the ambipolar diffusion of the core field leading to thermal surface emission. But there was a second component involving a process that we called Hall fracturing. The idea is that the magnetic field diffuses through the core of the neutron star, and it plausibly diffuses faster through the core than it does through the crust, so the field is forced through the crust. Now, in order for there to be a compressive or irritational expansion of the field through the crust, one requires that the crust crumble in small scales. And there is a very effective way of doing this involving Hall waves. And the point is that the positively charged particles in the crust are locked into a rigid lattice. And if you have a wrinkle in the magnetic field, then that wrinkle will propagate, and while propagating, rotate its sense of polarization. And that rotation is driven by the off-diagonal terms in the conductivity. Now, the point is that if you start off with this very strong field, vertically polarized, wrinkled, and then that wrinkle rotates into a partially horizontal polarization, that horizontal component of the field will fracture the crust. And the inferred wavelength of those fractures was about a tenth of a kilometer, and the energy released in each fracture was quite small compared to an SGR burst, only about 10 to the 34 or 10 to the 35 ergs per second. Now, one can then ask, what is the flux of charges from the surface of the star that is needed to support the Alphane waves that are excited in the magnetosphere when these internal seismic vibrations couple to the magnetosphere? And you can convert that particle flux to a cross-section for, in particular, for resonant Compton scattering at a radius of about 10 neutron star radii, where the surface X-rays will propagate through the electron cyclotron resonance. And for an Alphane wave luminosity in the range required to power the non-thermal persistent emission of these sources, it's a little bit less than unity. And there is only a very weak dependence on frequency. Okay. So this introduces the possibility of a converging flow in some portion of the magnetosphere with a optical depth not much less than unity. So that is a promising condition for producing a non-thermal spectrum, but I can't yet claim that it will produce something in agreement with the observed spectrum. Okay. There is another way of injecting particles into the magnetosphere. And that rests on the following observation, that in these very strong magnetic fields, the protons will have a cyclotron resonance in the X-ray range near the surface. And the X-ray flux can locally be above the resonant Eddington rate if the X-ray flux at the surface is spatially intermittent. You can then take this electron-ion flow and ask, what is the optical depth at the much extended radius where the electrons, the photons will interact with the electron cyclotron resonance? And it works out to be, with a very weak dependence, same weak dependence on frequency, close to unity. So in this case, you'll have regions of downflow, which in principle can produce extended power law spectra with the right amount of energy. Now, there is, I should emphasize, a fairly model-independent indication that something like this is going on. You have the inactive sources, the AXPs, with steep spectra and output predominantly in a black body component. You have the active sources with a much harder power law spectrum. And that power law X-ray output is much larger than the spin-down luminosity of the star. So those facts together point directly to a Comptonizing corona as the source of the power law X-ray emission. But one implication of that model is that the electron density in the magnetosphere should be well above the Goldreich-Julian density, about 1,000 times above the Goldreich-Julian density. So what this implies is that magnetars are not some souped-up version of a radio pulsar, but instead unipolar induction is essentially irrelevant to their output, not only on global energetic grounds, but even as far as radio emission is concerned. Now, there is one interesting possibility that is raised by this Hall fracturing model for a direct radio emission. That rests on the following observation, that if you have a shear Dalthane wave propagating away from the surface of the neutron star, it will have K-perb much greater than K-parallel, about 300 times larger. But as it propagates away from the surface, K-perb drops, K-parallel remains constant, and the ratio declines when you get out to the Alphane radius by a factor of a million. So you have a wave that's essentially the MHD analog of a vacuum electromagnetic wave by that large radius. So what this raises is the possibility that there will be direct conversion of these current-free Alphane waves to propagating low-frequency photons when the magnetic pressure of the undulating magnetic field begins to dominate the dipole pressure and the field lines are combed out and the field lines can no longer support this Alphane wave flux. Now, the inferred frequency is about a few megahertz for the Hall wavelength that we published, but there will be a high frequency tail. What that is, I have no idea from first principles. The recent detection of radio pulses from SGR 900 plus 14, however, was at low frequencies, about 100 megahertz. So this possibility should be kept in mind when considering models for that source. Well, that's really what all I wanted to say. These sources really do tie in with a number of interesting issues in supernova and classical gamma ray burst physics that will require an awful lot of further work for any real understanding. But they are interesting as physics laboratories in their own right, and they have the beautiful property of being close by, where you can actually see what their exterior conditions are like up close, and where multi-wavelength observations are comparatively easy to carry out. So, thanks.
Did I understand you correctly that you think binary evolution cannot produce large enough number of rapidly spinning cores?
I've tried. If you can do it, great.
Ralph, have you tried?
More far enough, I suppose. I would care to judge either way.
I'm not claiming that it can't be done. I'm just saying I don't.
No. As a note on that, of course, there is also still Finney's idea that if you have whatever it is that produces velocity kicks of neutron stars, if you try to velocity kick something that's very symmetric, you will also get a spin.
Well, the specific implementation of that idea in his paper involves non-radial neutrino emission. Okay, and the lever arm there was small enough. It's very hard to see how you could produce 10 to 52, 10 to 51 ergs in rotation. I think it's even implausible that you have the amount of you produce the amount of rotation that's in the Crab pulsar. The important thing to keep in mind is that the rotational energies of ordinary radio pulsars with spin periods of 30 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds are larger than their translational kinetic energies, and that indicates a larger lever arm than just the neutrino sphere.
You mentioned 4 times 10 to 15 Gauss. This is the field above which the diffusion changes. Do you think that could be relevant to the maximum field you might get in the sort of differential rotation chorus in classical GRBs along the line I was discussing? If you want some way to allow the field to get up to that strain.
If the field were amplified preferentially in an accretion torus, yes. Quite possible.
And returning to Lodak's question, when we carry out stellar revolution calculations and putting that Ingram sweep over all of the different angular momentum transport mechanisms we can, we do end up with neutron stars that are millisecond rotating. And so our problem has been, in fact, to make the slow ones, not to make the fast ones.
Do you include magnetic fields?
No.
Okay. Well,
I guess that's the one that I guess sure, like, if you want to say that doesn't work, you can go ahead and eliminate my talk on Wednesday, because without the rotation rate, you don't get the collapse on model of gamma radiation.
Well, but remember that classical gamma ray burst sources probably have a significantly lower birth rate than Falcon or Peters.
Well,
so,
it's hard to have a lower birth rate, but there may be a population of very rapidly rotating neutron stars that are born that way.
Can I argue against me?
Yeah, a question about the surface afterglow. I noticed you had a break in the spectrum, in the power law dependence on time.
Yeah.
And that implies the characteristic time scale, yeah. The characteristic time scale of the original illumination.
Yes.
What is that characteristic?
That's just the depth at which the electrons become relativistic. And so the transport coefficients change slightly.
I'm not sure whether you're appealing to a basic connection of these magnetars with their high velocity, because many pulsars show high velocity and they're not magnetars.
Well, there's nothing, I never said any.
You seem to imply by saying these are, 1,000 kilometers per second.
Some of them are, not all of them.
Well, there are only three, so two of them are 1,000 kilometers, the other one is.
Well, for example, the anomalous X-ray pulsar 2259, which doesn't appear in a binary, appears to be fairly close to the center of its supernova remnant.
Right, okay. Then my next question was, why do people really connect the soft gamma repeaters to anomalous X-ray pulsars?
Based on the strong similarities in the quiescent properties.
But you said they are not similar. I mean, these 1806 and 1900 have hard spectrum, and the others have soft spectrum. Soft spectra, so they're not similar.
But the X-ray, everything else is similar. X-ray luminosity, spin periods, spin down rates.
Right, but that I mean.
No, it. We don't have a direct diagnostic of the magnetic field strength in the anomalous X-ray pulsars as we do in the.
20, 8 seconds, and why is that also not an anomalous X-ray pulsar? And N49, our work has shown it's a thermal spectrum, it's not alpha equals 2, it's probably KT of 100 EV.
But it's been much less active recently than the other sources. Well.
If I could just follow up on that topic slightly of the AXTs and the interpretation of spectrum, thermal, and non-thermal. If I understand. Maybe if you could just clarify your model of the spectrum. Are you saying that the apparent power loss spectrum in X-rays is really the low energy tail of a cyclotron absorption resonance such that all the higher energy X-rays are absorbed as cyclotron resonances at different parts in the magnetosphere and only the soft X-rays can get out at a larger radius?
No. The idea is that you have resonant cyclotron scattering by an extended corona of energetic electrons.
Yes.
And that the resulting regions where the flow is converging, you have the right Y parameter essentially to produce a non-thermal spectrum of the observed index. That's all I've done. I don't have a realistic calculation of the three-dimensional corona.
None of that is really thermal emission then from the surface of the neutron.
You use the surface emission of seeds is the idea.
Any other question?
Yeah. Isn't there a similar fraction of very very highly magnetic white dwarfs? You need about 2% of neutron stars to be magnetars, and there is about a similar fraction of white dwarfs is very strong magnetic.
Well, field decay is more of an issue with white dwarfs. And in addition, the evolutionary pathways are different enough that I think it's dangerous to try and make any direct correspondences between them.
I'm not trying to suggest one from the other, but I'm trying to suggest that you go backwards to the progenitor, and maybe the way in which you produce the cybernetic field is not so exotic as you try to suggest, but there's something which is natural in the cores of stars, that some stars are just highly magnetic cores, and they maintain this in the collapse, and then some of them will go to white dwarfs, and this will be a few percent.
Well, one thing we look at, okay. The question was, where do white dwarf magnetic fields come from, and could this provide support for this idea that magnetic fields, strong magnetic fields, are a natural outcome of supernovae, I guess. So, well, we actually looked at this issue of how the equatorial field would scale with different phases of nuclear burning. And even in main-sequence hydrogen burning, you can get fields of about 10 to the 14th Gauss after allowing for compression to nuclear matter density. What distinguishes between the strongly magnetized and the weakly magnetized white dwarfs, we didn't have an answer to.
Last question.
Could you clarify, Chris, the presence of long wavelength afterglow, infrared, radio, and maybe optical, is created in this model only when you can blow out of the magnetosphere.
Yeah.
So that's only in these superburst events you can see such things.
You will have a persistent particle outflow, but at a much, much lower level.
But the short burst light, long wavelength afterglow, is equivalent to DRB light, the galactic version.
Well, I'd be reluctant to say you don't get any particle output. I mean, you do have these hyper-Eddington, the bursts are hyper-Eddington. But what's the real signature, surely, for a particle-dominated, pair-dominated outflow is these initial spikes. A burst which shows one of these very intense initial spikes is almost certainly undergoing one of these outflows. So that's, I think, a fairly direct phenomenological argument.
All right, we'll be back here in 25 minutes. Let's thank our speakers.